I'm going to explain everything that happens to the characters in Love Actually after the movie ends. Okay, Liam Neeson was just getting to know Claudia Schiffer when she was taken.
I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you are looking for a ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
You know what? At that pace, it's going to take me all day to do this. There are just too many characters. Can I get a high-speed drum track? The guy who married Keira Knightley was kidnapped and spent 12 years as a slave in the Deep South, but the guy who was secretly in love with her wound up as a sheriff leading a small band of survivors after the zombie apocalypse, which is confusing because Keira was last seen driving around with Steve Carell right before an asteroid hit the Earth. Even though the writer who married the Portuguese lady developed a speech impediment and became King of England, Hugh Grant lost his next election for Prime Minister, his girlfriend Natalie ballooned up to 380 pounds, and Hugh wound up in Cloud Atlas, a three-hour movie that nobody understands. I don't know what happened to the stupid guy who went to America to have sex, but two of the hot women he brought back turned out to be Betty Draper from Mad Men and Jack Bauer's super annoying daughter Kim. The guy who was the body double in the sex movie got all mixed up with dwarves, and he's currently on a 19-hour quest to cover 1 hour of actual Hobbit material. Sam, the little drummer kid, is now in Game of Thrones. The husband who bought the necklace for his secretary became headmaster of Hogwarts for about 5 minutes before Voldemort killed him, and actually his wife was a professor at Hogwarts too, but they must have gotten divorced because they never spoke to each other there. She also wrote all the Mary Poppins books. The secretary completely dropped out of sight, had a 7-year relationship with Daniel Craig, and is now in The Book Thief. Is that it? Is that everybody? No, wait! The aging rock star. I think he wound up at the best exotic Marigold Hotel, but I fell asleep after 30 minutes of that movie, and I'm not sure what happened to him. Anybody I didn't mention, and you can take this to the bank, is in at least one Doctor Who episode. Kill the drums! Today on the show, we're live in downtown Hartford talking about the second acts of classic Christmas characters. And now he still can't figure out how Alan Rickman wound up in Love Actually 15 years after Bruce Willis killed him in the best Christmas movie ever, Colin McEnroe.
And Die Hard is the best Christmas movie ever. Come on now. All right, so we are going to be talking about classic Christmas stories. Not that one, although I'm sure, given the talent we have here, a lot of things could be said about Love Actually and probably will be said about Love Actually. But that's not what we're here for. We're here for Christmas on the Rocks. That's at TheaterWorks right now. We also have with us from Christmas Carol, he'll be joining us in just a second, but he's out here with us already, Bill Raymond, who's doing Christmas Carol at the Hartford Stage Company. I want to tell you about Christmas on the Rocks, or I'm going to get them actually to tell you about Christmas on the Rocks at TheaterWorks. This is an unusual collaboration among a group of playwrights, all of whom have chosen a classic Christmas story and have completed it in some way. Although I'm probably not doing it justice, and since I have two of the playwrights right here, Jacques Lamar, since you're one of the playwrights, maybe set the scene for us a little bit. What happens at Christmas on the Rocks?
At Christmas on the Rocks, which was conceived by Rob Ruggiero, who's the producing artistic director over at TheaterWorks, what happens is we're at a bar in some lonely corner of the cosmos, and it's Christmas Eve, and a succession of beloved characters who were children in your favorite Christmas specials and movies and whatnot kind of come into this gentleman Mac's bar, and he kind of gets a download on what has happened to them since we last knew them, and also kind of tries to course correct them before they leave the bar. So it's seven different playwrights worked on each of the seven characters that Mac encounters, and what was really great was we all worked independently. So for most of us, opening night was the first time to see how it all gelled together.
Let me tell you who else is here. John Cariani is here. He's an actor and playwright who wrote Almost Maine. He wrote one of these playlets or vignettes or whatever we're going to call them. Playlets, I think, is nice. There's like small
yeah.
plays.
I mean, they're short plays.
Yeah, short plays.
And I don't like the word vignette.
Vignette is not
it's
good.
It's too fussy.
No, that's exactly. Not only that, but it's too incomplete. These are stories with beginnings and ends and stuff like that. Yes. John Cariani is with us. Also, Harry Boovy and Ron Carroll. They're both actors in Christmas on the Rocks. Ron's the bartender, and Harry is all the other male parts. As I said, in a little while, you'll also meet Bill Raymond. Male parts sounded wrong somehow, didn't it? I said that actually.
The show has female parts.
And there
too.
Are female parts also. Yes. Well. Yeah, there's really there's something for everybody, really, at Christmas on the Rocks. And I should say, we're at 231 Trumbull Street in downtown Hartford. If you happen to be, A, very brave, and B, somewhere in the vicinity, this is our kind of downtown Hartford WNPR location. Where we live was here this morning. We're sitting here among extremely expensive but very desirable items of denim, because they will be sold here later tonight. So this is kind of a storefront location. It looks out on Trumbull Street, just about directly across from Stackpole Moor, if you know that. And we'd love to have you come down. Our seats are filling up, but that's okay. We'll do something. We'll make you sit on the floor. But anyway, you're welcome to come in, and you can't buy any denim yet, but you could. I suppose you could browse. But mainly we want you to come in and visit and listen to the show. All right, so we'll talk a little bit more about this this production. John Cariani, first of all, tell us which character did you tackle?
I did Ralphie from A Christmas Story, and I was assigned him.
Oh, you were assigned Ralphie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Rob told me that's what he wanted me to do. And this is
that would be a signing.
Yeah. This I was actually
that's what a signing is.
Yes, and I was in Maine. It was summertime. I was in Maine, working on a new play that I had going up at Portland Stage Company, and he I think maybe springtime, and he called me and he said, "Do you want to write a part of a Christmas show that I'm working on?" And I was like, "Sure." I mean, Christmas is far away. Sure, why not? You know what I mean? But so he said, "Yeah, I'm going to ask a bunch of playwrights to do it," and that's what happened.
And how close a relationship did you have with the movie A Christmas Story and Ralphie? And
I never had seen it.
Okay. You did?
That's really? What I wanted, really.
Oh, wow. Isn't that funny? No, but I knew that he said he wanted me to do it because he said, really, the movie is a collection of vignettes. Really, yeah. It's a collection. I hate that word, but I said it.
See?
It's a collection See? Of short. It's a collection of short scenes that are interrelated, really. You know what I mean? All yeah. around a Christmas time. And he said that he thought I would, and he said the character was somebody that he thought I would appeal to me.
You know, this is a movie that's like a lot of other Christmas movies and some of the Christmas movies that we'll be talking about as we go along, which, I mean, it didn't really start out as, I mean, I think this is actually a pretty typical growth sequence for a Christmas classic. It didn't start out as this big freaking hit, right?
Yeah.
It didn't have like huge name actors in it for the most part, and it didn't have much of a rollout, similar to It's a Wonderful Life, similar to, I don't think anybody expected Love Actually to be what it's been, but it's turned out to be, I mean, it really has embedded itself. I mean, I think
I
most
had no
people,
idea.
If they make their top 10 list, this one's on it, right?
My brother said, it's my favorite movie. It's my favorite Christmas movie.
Your brother had never told you that before.
No, I never knew that.
So I don't want you to give away too much of what's happening to Ralphie, but, I mean, some of what happens to Ralphie in A Christmas Story obviously gives you some stuff to work with, right? Trauma.
Yeah.
He has trauma, right?
Yeah.
How much are you prepared to say about where you took Ralphie?
Well, I just was struck. When I watched the movie, I was saddened by his family didn't seem as happy as I thought they would seem. And they seemed to be capable of scarring a young boy, and that's what I examined.
Yeah. So Harry Bouvier, Ralphie is how old when he walks into Ron Carroll's bar?
I'd say he's probably about my age, 40, yeah. 46.
46?
Yeah.
And so did you... I mean, in taking a role like that, okay, everybody knows what this little kid looks like, you know? I mean, and what that little kid is like. How much of that little kid do you try to get up there?
It's interesting because I also play Hermie the Dentist from Rudolph, and I play Charlie Brown, and I also play, who's the third?
Tiny Tim.
And so, you know, when you sketch out these four different characters, you know, you want to sort of grab onto a characteristic from the movie you might remember. Certainly Hermie the Dentist is easy to do, and Tiny Tim has a British accent. So those were kind of like things we tapped into. And originally, when I started working on Ralphie, Rob and I discussed whether or not he should have a lisp, mm-hmm. because he has a lisp in the movie when he's a little kid. Yeah. And we kind of did maybe three lines from it and decided it was just way too ridiculous for a 46-year-old man to go entirely through an entire 10-minute play with a lisp. So we kind of got rid of that. But we did, you know, as soon as I put the glasses on, mm-hmm. it kind of just goes right with what people remember from the film.
Yeah, the goofy Ralphie glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ron Carroll, as a bartender, and we were talking about this before the show started. First of all, it's you're in an odd position as an actor because you're writing a part acting a part that is written by a whole bunch of different playwrights.
Yes.
So did they intuitively stay consistent? I mean, are you always the same bartender, or did that have to be kind of tweaked out as you went along?
The interesting thing was no one of the playwrights was informed about the character.
Mm-hmm.
So it was my job to sort of make him a through composed yeah. as the music.
So you really thought out his backstory a little bit. Yeah. What's he doing running this bar right now? What's he doing working in this bar? He probably doesn't own the bar.
I do own the bar.
You do own the bar, okay.
It was inherited by my father, and that mentions in one of the plays. I also, my own backstory has that I wear a wedding ring, which I don't like to take off when I'm working, simply because it's apt to get lost. Mm-hmm. So. But he is, I have him in my mind, his wife is deceased maybe 5-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's, and his bar is his life. The yeah. people that come in make it strange. Yeah. You'll see. But
is he the same bartender as in the Billy Joel song, The Piano Man? Is it the same? I was just wondering, because it seems like that's like my other context for like people coming into a bar and talking yeah. about their sad.
Well, it's not quite as bad as Long Day's Journey or something like that.
That was a much more high culture reference, though.
Yeah.
I think you get, you know, I went Billy Joel.
I used
went,
to have you know, Long Day's Journey.
Yeah, you went Eugene O'Neill, so you get points for that. I guess people still do hang around bars talking to bartenders.
Well, I have a speech in one of the things. It's, you know, basically, I say, you know, bars are not where people go anymore to meet others. You know, basically, that used to be where it was at, and I was sort of, yeah. you know, I was a guy who hooked people up when they came in, and mm-hmm. now it's online.
It's online.
And now, did you know that, like, most people meet, 10% of people start relationships in bars, and most people either meet at Walmart, like a Walmart-type store, or online. I looked it up because I was curious.
Yeah. So you were doing some demographic research.
Yeah, I wanted to know, because I didn't go to bars anymore. You know,
Where did you go to look that up?
I don't think
Walmart.
Where did you look that up?
It's something called Saddest Map in America. Look it up.
Yeah, Saddest Map in America.
That's what it's called.
It's part of Sadopedia, actually.
One thing about Max Bar is everyone who goes into and we didn't, no one came up with the name Mac. I think you came
I
up
did.
With that.
I did.
Yeah.
I came up with it.
But
I'll tell you why in a minute.
Everyone that comes into the bar is basically a loner. They're not there to really hook up or whatever. They're sort of lost souls in a certain sense. So Mac provides some holiday companionship for these people for the 12 minutes or so that they're in his bar.
So this is a good time, Jacques, for us to talk about your short play, which involves Charlie Brown, who I guess I didn't really think about having a massive drinking problem in later life, but it completely makes sense, right?
It does.
Although he's not coming in as a drunk. He just really needs to get away from his house, from his home, and his family. So it's... I think there's only one true souse that comes into the.
Yeah, who's the biggest drunk in the play?
She's Cindy not Lou here. Ho. She's hungover and will probably appear tonight. But, yeah.
but Cindy but, Lou and
oh, Cindy Lou is the biggest
Cindy
drunk.
Lou.
Is yeah. the biggest yeah. drunk.
Yeah.
But,
Cindy Lou from
Clara
Grinch.
From the Nutcrackers on her way.
Yeah.
She probably drinks the most prodigious amount.
I pour all of it, so yeah. I can tell yeah. how much. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you call anybody a cab?
No,
they all discuss this.
We discuss this.
Oh, really?
Because I called out that I say this was in Susan Walker character. Because mm-hmm. I said
this is
realize,
Miracle on 34th Street. We have to
yeah,
sort of
as a 10-minute play. I pour at in the original form. I poured 3 double shots, and I said, and the play ends by her talking about seeing her daughter and driving her somewhere, and I said, wait a minute. I once had a whole commercial yeah. canceled because I was at a bar for Hertz Cars or yeah. Avis or something, and I was downing them, and they were saying, why are you here? Well, I miss my flight, et cetera, et cetera. Well, why don't you rent a Hertz car? And I said, great. So I went in, and finally the lawyers saw that, and they said, well, what is this guy doing?
You know, somebody probably should have flashbacked that a little bit earlier. I mean, it just sort of really kind of jumps out as you're telling us, and it doesn't,
yeah.
it's not
so,
a good.
But I said that yeah. maybe, and so we did, in fact, cut down her consumption considerably.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea that Susan from Miracle on 34th Street would at some point be so drunk that somebody needed to call her a cab is everything that is kind of marvelous about the whole concept of this play, even though ultimately you've sobered her up a little bit. But Jacques, we'd have to hear a little bit more yep. about Charlie Brown. You know, that the Charlie Brown Christmas special, first of all, it's kind of controversial. I mean, as many people hate it as like it, right?
You know, I don't know. I always people really hate it.
There are people who hate it.
Do they hate it because it gets religious at the end?
No, I can send you a virulent essay written about it. I think in one of those sort of Deadspin Gawker type publications.
Oh, okay.
About just how abominable it is in every way.
That's interesting.
Because it's interesting because I can send you an article.
I didn't mean to be a buzzkill.
Reputable publication like Entertainment Weekly that says that they actually, like, advertisers go nuts for Charlie Brown Christmas. Yeah.
Although I have to say, before you continue, let me talk about me for a second. No, that for me, as somebody, I grew up reading the Peanuts cartoon comic strips religiously, and I had them in book form too as a little kid, and I loved them because childhood wasn't sanitized and it wasn't syrupy, you know. I mean, it really sort of dealt in a very, very real way about the fact that childhood is frequently depressing, it's frequently scary, it's upsetting, there are terrors, not everybody likes you, sometimes you feel like nobody likes you. These are all very strong realities for me. I thought, I'm not the only one.
And I think the special is true to that spirit, though, because everyone, including his dog, with the exception of Linus, is terrible to Charlie Brown.
Right.
And so when Charlie Brown walks into the bar...
How old is he now?
He's Harry's age.
Yeah. It's amazing how many of them turned out to be Harry's.
Well, I mean, the thing is, we were non-specific. We weren't writing to an actor. We were writing to the character, and we just knew that they were grown up at this point.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with... I feel like with Charlie Brown, especially because there's very little reference actually to the Christmas special in mind, because there is that, 60 years of the comic strip to draw from, plus the other TV specials and what we know of him from the musical and what have you. So, I probably had more material to work with than any other playwright, because there's just this cast of characters that is so deeply embedded in the American psyche.
So do you look forward with all the a lot of more of the characters? Like, we find out, like, what happened to...
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, Sally Schroeder, Pigpen, Frida...
I think we know where Peppermint Patty wound up.
Yes.
Into Northampton this weekend, actually.
There is an easy laugh there.
Yep.
But
well, what I found so good about it, too, is I just rewatched the Charlie Brown Christmas special as well, and it's virtually, parts of it are virtually the same for Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown, in the special, walks up to Lucy's psychiatrist stand, you know, and charges him a nickel. And he sits down and he says this very, as you say, he sits down and says, "Oh, Lucy, I'm depressed. Christmas is supposed to make me feel a certain way, but it doesn't. I'm so sad." And I think it's so radical to kind of have it, like you're saying, have a child sit down and say, "Christmas kind of stinks."
Yeah.
You know, and he can't understand his feelings.
Although part of the central, come on in, whoever, somebody's out on the street looking in. It's like a sad little Christmas movie. Like, can I come in?
Frozen.
You know, it's the central irony of that, too, is, first of all, I mean, mental health is only 5 cents. That's the good news. The bad news is that your psychiatrist is the most angry, abusive person you know.
That's right.
The person least likely to help you.
That's because you're only getting 5 cents.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's funny about, about what occurs with the audience and during my section, and also I noticed definitely in John's play, is that the audience, when you talk about something that happened to them after what we presume is a happily ever after of their special or their movie or what have you, is there'll be moments where you reveal something about, you know, something that's happened to them since then. The entire audience is like, "Oh,
yes,
like it's just there. There's a definite moment in mine, and there's a definite moment in John's, where the audience like gasps, like, "Oh no," you know, like, and it's funny how quickly they buy into the conceit of this is really what happened to these characters after you last saw them. I think it's very fascinating to watch, because it's like sitting down with a friend and someone being like, "Oh, well, you know, so-and-so died, or so-and-so got sick, or so-and-so lost their job," and you're like, "Oh, that's terrible." So they're responding to these characters on stage in a similar way.
Oh, I have a couple of questions. First of all, John Cariani, have you ever seen the Charlie Brown Christmas special?
Yes.
Okay. Because I had a concern that maybe you had never seen any Christmas movies at all, but
yeah,
this stuff started. And what happened to Linus? I played Linus in a touring production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, so I kind of need to know right here and now. I will be seeing this thing very soon, but I just got back from San Francisco, so I missed it. I was actually with Ralphie in San Francisco. It's a long story. But are you willing to say what happened to Linus?
Oh, he's just mentioned, but you know, basically, he's still a thumb-sucking, blanket-carrying social outcast. Is that fair to say?
That's right.
Yeah.
This is my point. The point where I go, oh.
And in fact, the one that storyline, a friend of mine commented that was one of the things that made him most upset.
Oh,
that Charlie and Linus weren't still close.
Oh,
it's interesting. I mean, it made him sort of just very sad because Linus was always his link. You know, at least Charlie Brown's one friend that he could count on.
I think that's a charitable interpretation of that reality too. It's not really clear. I mean, you know, one thing about those relationships in Charlie Brown is not really, there's no fondness of anybody for anybody, really. Right? Linus is usually kind of standing next to Charlie Brown saying something.
Yeah.
Maybe interpreting the world for him a little bit, right?
Right.
Yeah, and this is not really a spoiler, but watch for the first moment in the Charlie Brown scene. Mac is standing behind the bar with his elbows on the bar and his hands in his his chin in his hands. And Charlie Brown comes in and sits, you know, and mirrors the thing the way Linus and Charlie Brown would have been there next to each
other
at
that
wall. And it's this kind of nice moment. And then the first line always kind of busts the audience out. Yeah. I don't want to say what it is.
But it's so good.
Yeah. All right. First of all, I should say we're here in downtown Hartford. We're live here at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever time it is right now. We invite you to come down if you're wandering around in the cold. Otherwise, stay where you are. And we are talking right now to some of the playwrights and some of the cast of Christmas on the Rocks, which is at TheaterWorks, also here in downtown Hartford. And in the next segment, we'll add to this conversation Ebenezer Scrooge from Christmas Carol at Hartford Stage. We'll talk a little bit, too, about sort of everybody else's and your, the people who are on the show, your actual favorite Christmas movies and if there are other ones that you kind of want to in the future think about extending out or doing alternative realities for. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back after this.
Christmas time is here. Happiness and fun for all that children call their favorite time of year.
All right, we're back. We're down in downtown Hartford right now. We're going to be have sort of crosstalk between two Christmas plays in just a second. It'll be like Sharks and Jets a little bit. But first of all, I want to say we're in downtown Hartford. We're in this pop-up location on Trumbull Street. I want to say a couple of things about that. First of all, tonight, starting at 5 and running through 9, there's going to be this incredible small business retail experience in downtown Hartford. If you want to buy some things that, first of all, are truly connected to Hartford and maybe aren't the mass-produced items that you'll find someplace else, this would be a great place to go. It'll be here on Trumbull Street. It'll spread up onto Pratt Street. We've got the Hartford Prince location is used, the old Lex Bond location is used. Christina Newman Hartford Scott is here. Christina Newman Hartford Scott, am I missing anything? Are there any locations that I'm not naming? That's it. Okay. That's pretty much right. Okay. That would be a really good thing to do. I really want to get to this thing. I think it's going to be a terrific thing. It's such a great idea. So I want to mention that. I also want to just mention, so I don't forget to thank everybody, we have an incredible crew. Actually, the big kids from where we live are still here. John Jankowski, Katie Tularski are here. And my guys, Kyan Wolf and Betsy Kaplan are here. So, and we're happy that you're listening. So every couple of years, I'm sitting in the movie theater, and I'm watching some movie, or sometimes it's a television show, and I'll go, wait a minute, I know that guy. And I don't think, like, I know that guy, like, I've seen that actor before. I go, no, I know that guy. Who's that guy? And it's always Bill Raymond. It happened most recently watching Lincoln. I'm sitting there watching Lincoln and going, wait, I know, I personally know that guy. Who is that guy? He's played Ebenezer Scrooge in The Christmas Carol at the Hartford Stage Company for the last 87 years. And we don't have any idea what would happen if he wouldn't do it anymore. And we don't want to find out. But he's here with us today, and he's first of all, Bill Raymond, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
It's so exciting to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
And so great to have you back in Hartford. So I have to ask you. I mean, you've played Scrooge so many times. Have you ever thought about the next chapter of Scrooge's life? What's going to happen when the lights go down and the story goes forward?
Yes.
Are you prepared to divulge your thoughts at this time?
He dies.
Does he not have like any good years?
He's got some time.
Yeah.
He gives everything away.
Right.
He dies of starvation.
Is he still with Dilber?
Dilber kicks him out and sues him for divorce.
There you go.
That's not true. None of that is true. He lives forever.
But I see maybe it's become kind of a Warren.
The fact of the matter is, he was born in 1843, and he's still alive, and he's still going. He'll be going for probably, as far as one can imagine.
Well, phew, because I thought you might be prepared to cling to your first story, you know, and that was frightening and upsetting.
Well, that was just a joke.
I see him becoming kind of a Warren Buffett kind of guy, you know?
He's yeah.
like, sort of interested mm-hmm. in giving a lot of his wealth away and stuff
sure.
like that.
Yeah.
Why did that?
No, we have a reference to Warren Buffett in our segment, who references Scrooge.
In the Tiny Tim.
So I intuited that.
Yeah, you did.
So we have a guy who's Tiny Tim for, part of the play,
mm-hmm.
and we have a guy who's Scrooge for the whole Christmas Carol. Do you guys need to say anything to one another, or do you have anything you want to say to Tiny Tim right now?
How's your leg?
It's doing much better, thank you, because of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So the operation turned out all right.
Success.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to say anything about this. Tiny Tim, I mean, so many people in Christmas on the Rocks are not okay. Is Tiny Tim basically okay?
Yeah, Tiny Tim, he's living a fairly good life. I mean, he doesn't look like he's moved above his station very much, but he's still alive. He's still there doing it. I think what's great about the Tiny Tim piece in ours is that it's the evening is sort of shaped very interestingly. You know, the first two pieces kind of ease in, then two pieces come along and kind of smack you over the head. And the Tiny Tim piece is quite, I think, sentimental, which maybe goes along. It can become sentimental. At first, it's not. You find out that Tiny Tim is just kind of
jaundiced,
going from bar to bar on Christmas, trying to find a good Christmas experience. And he walks in, and this place isn't decorated to his liking, and he just kind of starts going off on Christmas. And the reference I have to Warren Buffett is that I say that he was the Warren Buffett of his time,
mm-hmm.
Maybe Bill Gates. And then I said, no, that would be post-schizophrenia. Before the schizophrenia, he'd be more Coke. Or what was that other fellow's name? Madoff. Yeah. it's fun. So, yeah. Very fun piece.
So, and Bill Raymond, yeah, it's actually like 14 years that you've done Scrooge here?
14 out of 16.
Mm-hmm. And, wow. So you are absolutely indelibly and inextricably wound up in Hartford's notion of Christmas. I have asked you about this before, but doesn't that mean that you don't get to be home for Christmas?
Well, no. I go home every Christmas. Yeah. I leave here on Christmas Eve, and we have our Christmas Eve. And then I come back the day after Christmas for the last three shows that we're going to do. Anyway, no. Lots of people come and from the city and they see.
People from New York come in to see.
And we celebrate Christmas. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good for our economy if they're coming to see you.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell them to buy some expensive jeans while they're here. Has it doing the show so many times for so many years, I mean, has it made Christmas different for you? Do you like Christmas more? Do you think about Christmas differently having been Scrooge for so how many hundred performances, however many hundred?
Gosh, what a question. Does it make it something else? Well, I actually was in a Christmas movie, and this is an answer to your question. I was in a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
It was called The Ref.
Oh, The Ref, yeah, The Ref, yeah. Which is one of the
great. I love that movie.
And that was a Christmas movie, and it starred
Dennis Leary.
Judy Davis and Dennis Leary and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. And what are you in The
Ref? And I play Santa Claus. I actually play, there were a lot of Santa Clauses in it, but I play the Santa Claus. And it's really George, the next door neighbor, who is a drunken Santa Claus, you know, sort of the precursor of the bad Santas, you know. So, and that was fun to do, and that was a good thing to have done. And that changed Christmas for me a little bit. You know. But and this does too, of course, because I've devoted a lot of years to being a grouch who actually isn't a grouch.
There must be little kids, people who were little kids who saw you, who are coming back now at age 20 or something. Right?
Yeah, they own businesses, they run film companies. And, true story. You know, the kids that were in the early Scrooges.
They run film companies, and are they hiring actors? That's the real question.
No, they do documentaries, of course. And my
cartoons.
It's the word the documentary. Anyway, so yeah.
So I also want to find out from all the you people up here, because it's great that you mentioned The Ref, because I mean The Ref, one of the things that I've noted, and I was thinking about it today, getting ready for this show and even working on the intro about Love Actually, is the expansion of our notion of what a Christmas movie is. I mean, I really do think that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, you know? I mean, it's kind of, you know, but I mean, that it's a pretty long trip from Holiday Inn to Die Hard, and in between you have these kind of action comedies like The Ref or Home Alone or things like that. I mean, there's so many things that are Christmas movies. So I'd be curious to know, just maybe just going around the room, starting with you, Jacques, because I know you also have an answer. I'm scared to ask John because he may not, you know, I mean, but...
Specifically movies or...
Well, you answer the question any way you want. That's...
Well, because I was thinking about The Ref because I actually watched it recently, and a friend had said that they had never seen it. I'm like, oh, you have to see this movie. It's great. It's set in Connecticut. I saw it when it was in the theaters here, back when the theater was open on Silver Lane in East Hartford. And there's a great line in it where Dennis Leary says, "Connecticut is the sixth ring of hell," or something to that effect. And the entire audience blew up. We have a sense of humor about ourselves. But, you know, it's set in old Baybrook, Connecticut, and you just recognize these people as people who live around here. So I have a particular affection for The Ref. I remember the first time I saw the Radio City Christmas Spectacular, by the end of it, I was literally in tears because it brings you back to that childhood moment of Christmas.
How old were you when this was happening?
I was probably my 30s, because I grew up in New Hampshire, had never been to Radio City, and then went to see it, and I was just, it's so overwhelming, and, you know, hitting you over the head with every ounce of Christmas cheer, and you, like, get bludgeoned and submit. And then for TV specials, Pee-wee Herman's Christmas special is my absolute favorite Christmas special.
All right. Well, that was a very complete answer.
Thank you.
And I think also, and it was multi-platform. I like that. And I think it is true, too, that it's very hard to, like, for example, in my house, I happen to live with somebody who has probably watched Love Actually, well, let's just say an unhealthy number of times. She's probably watched Love Actually as many times as Bill Raymond has played Scrooge. Not like as many years has Bill Graham.
How
as
old
many
is
times
she?
As and so and every time it's on, if I'm in the room, I go, that is the most. I mean, it's just like a bottle of syrup that we're just going to drink
down. I love that movie.
Yeah, well, at the end, I'm going, oh, that's so nice.
But I love that movie too.
The Emma Thompson thing is heartbreaking. That's it's not a bottle.
No,
of
that
syrup.
Is that's horrible and
the Bill and I relationship with it, you know, his yeah. buddy and
they get drunk and watch porn at the end
that's
of the movie.
Right.
That says Christmas to me. I don't know about you, but so John Cariani, what's your favorite?
I haven't seen Love Actually.
No, wait.
I want to defend myself
though.
You
haven't seen Love Actually? Or I haven't
the movie.
Seen Love Actually.
He actually hasn't seen Love Actually.
Yeah. Just to defend myself a little bit, I grew up in Northern Maine, and we had Canadian channels and one channel that show was at affiliates of all the networks. So
and you weren't
we didn't have
night,
cable right? till I was older because yeah. till I was because we had to have more enough houses in your mile and all that stuff. And we didn't.
I didn't mean to put you back on your.
No, that's okay. Spot,
it's okay that you haven't.
I grew up in the far more civilized New Hampshire, apparently.
But no, it's funny because I remember Christmas where I'm from was all there was so much snow and they did this thing where they lit all of the streets in my town with bags of candles. So it was just a little town, but all the streets had candles. So it was really cool. And I remember Christmas Eve Mass. It was awesome because all the lights and stuff. So I remember that more than specials. But my favorite Christmas movie, I think it's Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol?
Just because that's the best story ever, I think.
Yeah. Is this the Alistair Sim Christmas Carol? There's like a few
It was old, and I loved it. That's all I remember. I think it was the old one. Yeah.
Alistair Sim.
Yeah, and my father was surprised I watched it because he thought I would fall asleep or be bored. And I was just like, I love the ghosts. I thought the ghosts were the coolest thing. And then I was like all into like, whoa, what would it be like if we knew what could happen in the future? You know what I mean? Like it starts that thing in your head. And my favorite TV special was The Grinch.
Really, The Grinch,
absolutely, because that song's awesome. Yeah. And I love Dr. Seuss. So.
Did you find it hard to see what happened to Cindy Lou Who in the play?
I had a very hard time when I saw the first rehearsal, I have to be honest. You were there.
Yeah.
I kept kind of, I did this a lot. I just kept, you know, like putting my head in my hands because I was, it's, that's the cool thing is when you watch this play, you think, oh, I don't remember that one. And then you do remember it as you watch the scene and you, it's a weird experience of remembering the actual tale that as it was told and then marrying what happens in the future. It's very upsetting in a very funny
but,
way.
Yeah, but the thing is the audiences are generally they're laughing throughout and then at the end people are actually getting a little bit teary and it has a weird cumulative effect of like we've created a new Christmas tradition. It's very interesting.
Well, hopefully you have. He's talking. Well, by the way, if you're just coming in, coming into the show, we're talking about Christmas on the Rocks at TheaterWorks. We're also talking about Christmas Carol at Hartford Stage Company. We're live downtown with some of the actors and playwrights. So, and we're just sort of kind of going around, kind of sampling people's actual favorite Christmas fictional product. So, Ron Carroll, what's on your list?
Well, first, I'm old. I guess I'm the oldest person in the room. I don't know, but we didn't have any TV. My dad thought TV was a passing fancy. And so I think it was 1948 that TV came to our particular town in Virginia by, you know, network. And in 52, when I went off to college, it still had not come to our house. But my memories, I remembered going to Radio City when I was in college to sing on the stage. And when I saw that organ with 45,000 ranks of pipes and all, and the hydraulics that took it down, that was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. Plus, it seemed like a million people out front. And then when I read Catcher in the Rye, you remember when he sat there watching the Christmas special? And behind him were the people from Keokuk, Iowa, saying, "Look, it's right together. Those feet are kicking right together." You
know, I remember him. He also says that the angels look like they want to go have a cigarette.
Exactly. And I kept seeing the yellow. I had just seen Moses, the movie, and noticed the yellow stains on the actor playing Moses. But So I was a little skewed view of Christmas.
That Chesterfield commercial where Moses endorsed the cigarettes, I thought was taking it way too far. But it was the 50s.
But anyway, you know, this has been a terrific experience for me.
Christmas on the Rocks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the
because I get to learn of all the stories that I didn't see on TV. Yeah.
I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this or not, but you know, one of the things that did not get dealt with on Christmas on the Rocks, but may in a future iteration, is the story of George Bailey and the story of
from Zuzu's perspective. David Lindsay Abaire, who wrote Rabbit Hole and Good People, really wanted to participate, but he's got a bunch of different projects that kept him from it. So he's asked Rob to kind of reserve Zuzu for his attention. I wrote one for Jesus.
It's hilarious. It's so funny. It's so funny.
And, I think we know how Jesus' story comes out.
But I mean, when you think about a famous child from A Christmas Story. The most famous one would be Jesus. So
although Ralphie is creeping up at this
point. Yeah, Ralphie is creeping up. Not apparently as far up as Maine, but they just got electricity recently. But You know, and there's also Karen from Frosty the Snowman. So I think Rob's intention is to possibly, you know, rotate in other plays and playwrights at some point. I think we're all, like, you know, feeling like real estate. We don't want to lose our spot. Right. But
you're bumped, yeah.
But, you know, it's something that could help sort of freshen up the show for years to come. But I think that TheaterWorks is committed to turning this into an annual tradition, which is very exciting.
Just back, Ron, back to It's a Wonderful Life. You were in there's a musical, really fully seen in New York anyway.
Well, it was seen in New York. Yeah. We did a full, you know, sort of staged production at the Schubert Theater on the day off of the show that was running, which I think was Spamalot at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a lovely musical. Maybe I'll get sued, but she was the daughter of the man who wrote the original short story on which the movie was based. She, in effect, has the rights to the story. Mm-hmm. So to get the rights to play in New York or any other theater is up to her. It has played in certain places.
What did you play? What were you?
I played the father of George.
George's father, yeah.
And it had a lovely song.
Yeah.
I remember that.
I'm trying to picture what the songs are, and it's a wonder, like Welcome to Potterville. I don't know. It's, you know.
Well, I mean, some of them were fun, and some were very moving. And we had an interesting cast because you weren't cast necessarily because you were like, you know, the character movie. They just had people they wanted to
Judy Kuhn and Judy Kuhn and
Judy
Brian
Judy
Stokes Kuhn. Mitchell.
Brian Stokes and Mitchell played pretty, George. Yeah.
And, tell me Violet Bick has her own number. If Violet Bick doesn't have her own number, I would see it.
Well,
gosh, wasn't it Karen? Didn't Karen Ziemba?
Karen Ziemba.
Karen Ziemba played
a veteran of the Hartford stage, actually. Karen. Hey, we have to take a quick break here, or I'll lose total control of the clock. We still haven't heard the favorite movies of Harry or of Bill, so we have to do that when we come back, and we'll give you yet more. The ever-popular More from Trumbull Street after this.
I did leave one thing out of my Love Actually follow-up. I should have mentioned that the President of the United States wound up as a drunk department store Santa peeing on himself. And that really, it says Christmas to me, you know? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Jackie Lauper. Greg Hill is our tweetmaster at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bill Murray. For photos, links, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff hammered on champagne punch and singing White Christmas, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, The Nose talks about smarm, snark, the politics of who does the housework, and Time's Person of the Year. And now, back to Colin.
All right, and we are here on Trumbull Street. Let's prove that we actually have an audience here. Let's do one of those, Also want to say a special thanks to Gina Matruda, who stays back at the mothership and makes sure that this whole thing doesn't just, you know, get stuck on Trumbull Street and never go out over the air, which is a key component. Every chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So we're talking about Christmas shows. There are fabulous Christmas shows here in downtown Hartford that you can go see by buying a ticket to the Hartford Stage's Christmas Carol. Bill Raymond, who plays Scrooge, is here with us right now. Also, Christmas on the Rocks over at TheaterWorks. And we have many people from Christmas on the Rocks with us right now.
Can we drop the websites for people?
Drop anything you want to drop.
So HartfordStage.org for Christmas Carol and TheaterWorksHartford.org for Christmas on the Rocks.
Yeah.
I'm a shameless marketing person.
You're so smart. You're good.
But you're wonderful at it.
Thank you.
You do it with aplomb. So I was just sort of sampling people, kind of finding out what their real sort of, their most sort of Proustian relationship with some Christmas classic is. And Harry Booby, who's playing all the male parts except the bartender in Christmas on the Rocks, what's your answer to that question?
Oh, mine always was It's a Wonderful Life. And we've talked about it so much already, but... It's a Wonderful Life also is a one-man. There's a one-man version of It's a Wonderful Life that I did several years ago in Cincinnati, and that sort of made me hate that movie.
was it the Cincinnati part?
I played something like all 30 characters or something and did all of their voices and did all of the, Zuzu with the an angel gets its wings, you know, and that stuff. But I also got bronchitis during the run of that show, and I didn't have an understudy, and I still had to go on. So Zuzu sounded like this, basically. And it was just, you know, it was a very difficult show to do because, really, I've done 4 one-man shows, 2 of which were at Hartford Theater Works years ago. But that one was one of the hardest because it really was not a play per se, because everyone knows the film so well. Yeah. It was kind of just people coming to see how good of a Jimmy Stewart impersonation I did. Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of suspense, you know. But I still, if that scene with George in the bar, when that comes on, when he's talking directly to God and it kind of zooms in on him, Jimmy Stewart, that is one of my favorite scenes of all time in any film of any actor. I think he's so raw and honest in that moment. Yeah. It makes me just sob every time I see it.
I get the same way when Bruce Willis kills Alan Rickman.
Yes.
It's the same thing.
I've never seen that. Never seen that movie. Probably my favorite TV Christmas special is probably Year Without a Santa Claus. That's the one with the Heat Miser, right? I love that song, those songs particularly. So.
All right, so Bill Raymond, how about you? I mean, you could say Christmas Carol. That could be your answer, but we just...
I'm going to say Christmas Carol. I'm going to say it, yes, with Alistair Sims.
Was that the case before you started?
Yes, I loved it. I watched it every year, and I loved Alistair Sims in it, and I must say, a nice way to say it is I do impressions of him, but... You wouldn't recognize
but, him. Yeah, you don't. that that really is completely untrue. Your Scrooge is very much your own.
A conceit, you know. Yeah. I love that. And I also love Bad Santa.
so glad to hear that.
Which is
actually
one of the most touching movies I've ever seen in my entire life. Yeah. And also, I love A Wonderful Life and a joke that Jimmy Stewart told one time.
Which was?
The one to David Letterman where he said, I can't tell the story on the air. I wish you could tell this because I can't do this. he says, I'll make it faster. I says, well, this is a nice couple. You like this couple. This is very nice. They live on Park Avenue. They're having breakfast. They're on the terrace. And she says to him, she says, John, he says, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about, well, what if I die before you do? He said, well, don't talk like that. I don't want it. It's too more. He said, no, what if I do? What would you do? Would you get married again? He said, don't, I'm not going to. So then they're having dinner. She says the same thing. He says, all right, I'll answer it. He says, yes, I would. You would get married. He says, yes, I know I would. Yeah. Well, would you keep our house? Would you stay here? He says, yeah, I think I would. He says, well, what about our bedroom? Would you sleep in the same bedroom with her? I says, of course I would. Our same bedroom? Yes. He says, well, what about my golf clubs? No, she's left-handed.
that
happened on Christmas, actually.
Yeah, it's a very Christmassy story. I mean, it's implicitly a very Christmassy story. Just very quickly, when will the next time be that I sit in the audience and go, wait a minute, I know that guy. Bill Raymond, we should typically say Bill Raymond's been in, this has happened to be watching The Wire.
Clockers.
Michael Clayton. I'm sitting there watching Michael Clayton.
I have to say, you have the fastest eyes of anyone I've ever met.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting there clueless, you know. But anyway, I was looking at IMDb. You do have some stuff coming up, including a movie that has something to do with Sandy.
Miami Vice, yeah. I saw that a couple of weeks ago, actually.
But don't you have a movie coming up that has something to do with Hurricane Sandy?
Hurricane Sandy.
It says it's in post-production in IMDb.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe they just photographed you and didn't tell you. All right, so call your agent immediately. All
I'm,
right?
I'm underwater.
You're apparently in a movie that you don't know anything about.
It's about Hurricane Sandy.
Or it has something to do with Hurricane Sandy. Really? All right.
Oh, okay. There's not a lot of that I can talk about. That's coming up.
All right. Make it a surprise for me, because it was really fun sitting there in Lincoln going, who's that guy playing Skylar Colfax? Yeah. All right. We have to sort of wrap things up here. I want to quickly, once again, thank everybody connected to this whole thing for making it happen, especially the people from... is it called iConnect? I can't get all the things for iConnect, right? That's what it's called. Okay, so Christina Newman Hartford Scott is here with us, and I do totally recommend tonight from 5 to 9. There's going to be this great small business retail experience down here with the Hartford Denim people who are going to be operating out of this Trumbull Street location where we are right now, right up to Hartford Prince, up on Pratt Street, and a lot of things in between. It would be a great thing to do to support downtown businesses, and you're going to get really unique, unusual Christmas gifts. Thanks to everybody from WNPR. I'm getting the wrap-up sign. Goodbye.
Walking in the winter wonderland, gone away is the bluebird, here to stay.
I'm Kyone Wolf with an update on what happened to the three characters of each segment of The Human Centipede. They, nothing. They're dead. Really. Dead.